I don't know how often you reach for a commentary that is homiletical. I don't know whether also you go through certain phases. I remembered my own Lenski phase, you know. That was the commentary for me every day. I bought the whole set. It was my most treasured possession. And then, I don't know why, but as there came a time when I was not satisfied each time I turned to Lenski, not because he didn't have something to say. He had something to say, but his explanation seemed to be more coming from a Lutheran standpoint than from a more objective biblical standpoint. Well, I seldom turn to Lange, but I can see why some people would love their Matthew Henry's and their Lange's commentaries, because these commentaries really contain the kind of information that they like, not just technical information, but also the more illustrative ones, especially if you're trying to prepare a talk. I don't find Excel commentary too helpful, but it is a voluminous series, 57 volumes of the Biblical Illustrator. And it's actually a compilation of various opinions. Now, for the volume of words that you read here, one would expect, you know, he would come up with certain discussion of exegetical problems, but I didn't find that. Well, Excel, for instance, accepts the last 12 verses of Mark as authentic, and it says it fits very well the rest of the gospel, quote, with a perfect and exact harmony, close quote. Wow. But I would question that statement. Now, the commentaries without Greek, again, I don't know how many of you turn to that, but I do use, I find myself using my Tyndale commentaries quite a bit sometimes. I'm often asked, now what commentary do you recommend? Or which is the best commentary on Mark? I find it hard to answer a question like that. Because I would recommend, what I would recommend may not be something that would be suitable for another person. I think a person whose primary ministry is as a pastor may exult over Lange, Matthew Henry, Martin Lloyd-Jones, you know, or a person who has interest in more theology than anything would exult in De Graaf's Promise and Deliverance and John Murray, or some of the more reformed publications. But when I go to a commentary, I like to see the Greek or the Hebrew. And the more I can excavate from the text in that way, the better it is. So that's my kind of commentary. But the commentaries that do not use Greek are not always unhelpful. I find that many of them give very excellent discussions. Now, I'll comment on Hunter. Hunter's treatment, 1949, is based on the AV, and it is theological in approach. There is a brief introduction, but he shows his liberal bent when, for instance, he takes the demoniac in the synagogue, Mark 1:21-28, as an epileptic rather than an actual demon-possessed case. There's a tendency to deny demon possession. C.F.D. Moore's commentary on Mark interested me quite a bit, because here is a man who is a top scholar. Hunter is also a top scholar, but not of the not of the same stature as Moore. It's a solid piece of work, and I could see in several places that it must have been very difficult for Moore to say briefly what he wanted to say, because he had so much. You get this feeling, he always has more to give. I'm used to reading a lot from Moore, and to see him just making very brief comments, really something. Hello, yes. Yeah. This is a Presbyterian work. He has some good notes. And I find that he is dead center on the problems, on the essential problems. He often satisfies, you know, although the book is brief, he doesn't miss a discussion on the notes.
What do you mean by dead center?
That means he doesn't bypass a problem. He tackles a problem, even in a small commentary. I don't mean dead center in his theology. some people don't accept William Barclay or Oliver Barclay. What I like are his contemporary anecdotes that livens up commentary. And I find if I want a sermon illustration, I prefer to go to Barclay than to Langley. You know why? The illustration from Langley is very much what you find in the Treasury of David. They're all in sundry, you know, some with greater relevance, some not as relevant. But Barclay would actually take a point, and his illustration is not extraneous to that point. Okay, R.A. Cole. Now, I must say something about Cole. He wrote this commentary from Singapore, and he laments that he was writing from a theological wilderness because of the lack of sources, and that's often what I find. Mm-hmm. It's based on the AV, as all the Tyndale commentaries are, and it's written from an Anglican standpoint, and you would find, you would think, you know, in a small commentary that he would be very brief on certain things. But I enjoyed reading very much his introduction to Mark. It was a really full and lengthy introduction. Now, I would use Cole's commentary as well as any other Tyndale commentary, not for checking up on a certain point. I feel very often, if you want to find out something and you go to Tyndale, you won't find it there, because by design it is a brief commentary. But it's good for a person who is working through Mark, and you have your Bible open, you have your Tyndale commentary open. As you are reading Mark, you are reading the Tyndale commentary. You are sort of working with it. You're not working from the problem to the commentary, but rather from the text. You may read a passage and you have no problem with it, you know. And if you read Cole, he will highlight things for you in a useful way. I find the Tyndale commentaries in many church libraries unused because of the wrong way people are using Tyndale. If you have a library in your, a church library, and someone is able to recommend to people who use it, tell them to use Tyndale in that way. For that matter, it is not advisable to put Tyndale on reserve. Reserve books are for you, on reference, for you to go and check up a point. It's much better to allow a church member to check out commentary to use consistently.
I found with my Tyndale commentaries, I gave most all of them to school in the Philippines, because I didn't find them any helpful. Uh-huh.
Yes. Well, there comes a time, yeah, where it may not help you, but it probably would help someone else. Branscombe, Mark Moffat's 1937. This is a liberal commentary. He has a lengthy discussion whether the Mark who wrote the Gospel is John Mark or some other Mark. Most people would find that a curiosity piece rather than anything else. The authorship of Mark has been accepted by and large. Branscombe leaves this as an open question. And on a certain matter like the baptism of Jesus, Branscombe thinks it was an attempt by the early church, quote, to pierce the mystery of the forces that lay behind Jesus' decision to begin his proclamation of the coming kingdom of God. It is a subtle denial. He's trying to say here that this really didn't happen, but the early Christian invented this incident as a suitable symbolic representation of what Jesus meant. And so if you want a liberal opinion on something, you would find it in this book. Hugh Anderson. Anderson's work, 1976, is written from the Scottish Presbyterian standpoint. He noted a shift from historical criticism to redaction criticism, and he is more concerned with Mark's theological purpose than historical reliability. He is a redaction critic, and he moves through the text of the RSV. It's based on the RSV. Now, the commentary is dealing with Greek. Calvin's commentary, I think, has not been accorded the place that it really should. It was written in 1555, and you can say Calvin should be considered the prince of commentators. I would much rather read Calvin's commentaries than his institutes myself. Unfortunately, the format is difficult to use.
That's right.
Because Calvin writes as a harmony. Yes. And if you want to follow Mark, you have to look at the index all the time. But if you can keep at it, it is excellent. You will find that many of Calvin's views, it doesn't strike us as something extraordinary, because we have read it in some more recent commentary. Actually, many of the commentators of the 19th and 20th century took their views from Calvin, you know. So it's important, and he's very sensible in his commentaries. As I said, the commentaries are a good corrective against misinterpretation of the institutes. Hendrickson, this is a Christian Reformed work. He's at Princeton. He studied at Princeton, and he is a professor of New Testament literature at Calvin Seminary. This is part of the New Testament commentary series. I find some good notes there, and what I like especially are the summaries at the end of each section. I find it frustrating to use a commentary that just goes verse by verse without stopping to assess the situation. And I like the way Hendrickson stops and reviews and gets his bearing before he moves on again. William Lane, well, I have already mentioned something of him. William Lane's commentary is actually very good. He uses the ASV 1901 text. A student of Dr. Stonehouse, and in fact he was assigned to write this commentary before he completed his doctorate. William Lane noted in his commentary, whenever he came to a difficult point, he would just lay the Bible open and pray over that problem, and very
often the Lord shows him the answer.
I hope the Lord will show him the answer concerning the temptation. Yes. But it is a good attitude anyway. Personally, I feel that Cranfield is right. He says in Romans, he says, anyone who thinks that he has completely understood Romans 9-11 must have misunderstood Paul. You know, those verses concerning Israel are so problematical. And if you feel you understand everything that Paul says, something is wrong. I like a commentator who is humble and who recognizes he doesn't really understand everything. Lenski, 1946. I will use Lenski mainly for the syntax, his observations on syntax. Now, I find that Lenski tries to do a lot of original work on his own. If this came through as a student exegetical notebook, it would be excellent. But I found little use for him because that commentary lacks footnotes and it lacks a discussion of other views than his own. You know, I prefer to see more views, but I find it frustrating sometimes to use Cranfield and others who would give you 10 or 12 different views, and it's really confusing to know which one you should choose.
You prefer a commentary that would pick the best, several of the best.
Oh, they often do. They give you the views and pick out what they like. But I would like to see that certain views be totally discounted, you know, which are really not worth even mentioning. Well, let's mention now Sherman Johnson. Johnson, 1960, was the dean of the Church Divinity School in Berkeley, California. He doesn't rule out redaction criticism, and in fact he shows a favorable attitude towards it, although he says he prefers to keep an open mind. Typically, like other scholars, he sets out the evidence and he says there is no way to determine exactly what happened, and then he moves on. I find that there is an unwillingness to sometimes face a decision, and that is not a good trait. Especially an unwillingness to relate Mark to the faith level of commitment. For instance, when he discusses the question of miracles, he came so close, you know, in admitting that, well, these things could have happened, but he simply, these things did happen, but he simply stopped short of that point. Well, I can understand it. This is pre-understanding. It prevented him to go further. But that's no excuse. Cranfield, I've mentioned him several times. He is brief. That's what I like. I don't have to read too much about of him. He's up to date. And he's very cautious. I'm glad to see that at certain points, although I wouldn't characterize him as an evangelical, I'm glad to see that he's prepared to just discount the liberal opinion on a certain point. And this is what I like to see too about passes around. C.F.D. Moore. It's really interesting to find C.F.D. Moore defending original sin. You know, or when he speaks about the historicity of Christ and those who try to split Jesus, the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith, he is very scathing in his denunciation of that. Let's pause for a while. Cranfield is available. Sometimes you mention a commentary that is not available. The only way to find it is in second-hand bookshop, if you can find it.
How expensive is it?
The price is there, excuse me. $17.95 Canadian.
What would you say the whole series is like?
This is the whole series. Cranfield, I don't know whether you have noticed, a Cambridge commentary for schools and colleges. It's a slender thing. Now, this is an attempt to revise that.
Oh, this is the first one that's out.
Yes, first one that is out. But it is 1952.
Oh, so it looks like they've given up, right?
1955, yes. Yes.
There's no more work being done. Probably.
Well, not that I know of.
It's going to be awfully big.
Greek Testament commentary, one edition.
But if you really want a commentary that deals with the Greek, you'll find the most up-to-date one.
Yeah. I've heard that.
Yes.
I've heard one recommended by Eadie.
Yes, John Eadie.
Is that only the Pauline? Or?
I can't tell you offhand what it is, but
I know that
it's funny. I have seen that several times. I've used it, but I've never...
E-A-D-I-A.
That's an old Greek name.
Yes. I have not really found much use for it.
No.
It's a lot of heavy reading.
Well, Ezra Gould has some, his format is excellent, some helpful notes, but for some reason, which I have not yet been able to figure out, he doesn't come across well. William Barclay, this is what he says about Ezra Gould, he's out of date and it is a sadly inadequate work. Coming from William Barclay, that's surprising. It's like F.F. Bruce. You will not find in any review by F.F. Bruce that he will say something is bad. He will always just say a good point and leave it at that. That is something which I would say is not an asset. You know, sometimes we need to say something is bad. But he does, under certain situations, I found him to be very, very clear. And denunciation is there. But he makes a big difference between speaking as a scholar and speaking as a churchman. Plummer, 1914. It is an out-of-date work, but it is helpful. I feel that some of these books, if you can come across this in a second-hand bookstore, anything by Plummer, you should grab. Because he is good. His notes are brief, but they're helpful. A.B. Bruce, Expositor's Greek Testament, Scottish Presbyterian. The notes are very helpful. Again, if you find Expositor's Greek Testament, you ought to grab hold of it. Alfred, 1849. Alfred writes as an Anglican. He follows the Cambridge tradition. You'll find that the Cambridge and the Oxford tradition can be generally characterized as follows. The Cambridge tradition, coming from the famous trio Lightfoot, Westcott, and Fort, emphasized a close study of Greek texts. Now, those who are in Oxford would turn up their nose and say, oh, those guys at Cambridge, they're just technicians. You know, they know how to write copious notes, and it looks scholarly, everything is so well discussed. But they are chatty little notes. But the Cambridge people still continue to turn out many good technicians. The guys at Oxford are good in their historical theology and philosophy. They emphasize the theological approach more so than a biblical theological approach. And while the Cambridge guys would say the same thing about them, you know, that if only they would pay more attention to the text and take the prima facie interpretation rather than force their own theological outlook on the text. So it's the charge of eisegesis. I think you need to have a mixture of both. You need to be a good technician to know your Greek and Hebrew, and at the same time, you need to see how a theological approach can be built up on the basis of exegetical data, reliable, sound exegetical data that has been gathered properly. You know. In other words, we are going back to square one and doing the foundational spade work, and we feel that that would affect the final result. For this reason, I find reading liberal writings that are exegetical in nature to be more fruitful than reading liberal theological works. I have a hard time getting through Brunner's The Mediator, or trying to read Karl Barth's Church Dogmatics. You know, I find a deep disinterest sets in as you go on further and further. But as you read Meyer's commentary, for instance, or TWNT, you know what that is, Kittles, you find that while you may disagree with the conclusions, you are helped by the data that are produced by these people, because whether you are a liberal Greek scholar or an evangelical Greek scholar, you still have to work with the Greek language. And I think this is where we see the common ground, but we diverge on the basis of our pre-understanding. Alexander, 1858. This is a typical example of what can be considered worthy of a commentary in the mid-19th century. The notes are interesting, but they are not really on controversial questions that are raised today. In fact, if you pick up a commentary, you just flip through it, you can tell pretty well whether it's a 20th century commentary or a 19th century commentary. For instance, Sweet commentary. You know, for more than 50 years, Sweet, well, I'm coming to him now. Am I right? Okay, I'm on to Sweet. This was the best commentary on Mark. It was written in 1898. It's a scholarly work. It has a wealth of information. I'm surprised to find Syriac, Georgian. He discusses things. He has one whole chapter just listing Greek vocabulary words used once in Mark, you know. And he does all these this work. Well, I find his introduction more helpful than his commentary. I like his discussion of Papias, especially when he uses the original text. And he lays out the evidence. You are given a chance to decide for yourself. When Taylor wrote his work, 1952, he personally acknowledged his indebtedness to Sweet. And he says, well, he's now trying to update Sweet. And Vincent Taylor's work, I would say, is the most popular liberal work on Mark at the moment. Vincent Taylor. I find it helpful, although you have to be careful not to accept everything he says. Both Sweet and Taylor carry on the Cambridge tradition of doing fine exegetical work.
Okay. Could you say something further about Alexander?
I feel his questions, the questions that he deals with, doesn't touch on areas which are crucial. And that's not saying that the work is therefore trivial. But today we have, for instance, the arguments for the priority of Mark has changed the whole picture very much. Now, Mount used to be neglected until it was realized where it stands in the transmission history of the Gospels. Alexander doesn't bring out all of these things, but he has done good work. He doesn't say enough for me. You have that commentary.
That's my favorite commentary.
Yes.
I probably have 15 or 20 commentaries on Mark. That's my favorite.
Uh-huh.
That's why I'm interested in
okay.
evaluation.
Well, I can see how that can be the case, because I personally I would prefer Sweet's commentary over Alexander. Okay. I find, I must really hurry up. Vincent Taylor is very easy to use. He's clear-cut, he's careful, but sometimes too reserved. He doesn't really come out and say Mark is historical. He says it's most likely that it is so. Menzies. The Greek text is given, detailed notes are given, but since he's a form critic, I found very little use in him. All these commentaries are found in the library, by the way. But still, for some exegetical notes, it's good. Sometimes you want to do a thorough study on a particular verse, you know, and therefore it's good to scan all these. Lightfoot was a tutor at Oxford. Don't confuse this with Joseph Lightfoot. This is not a commentary as such, but a series of lectures. Lightfoot finds a picture of Jesus in Mark baffling, and he says it's not likely to inspire reverence. He's not writing as a sympathetic person. Schweizer, Edward Schweizer, redaction critic. He's openly redactional, and his conclusion is that we don't know who wrote Mark. The writer is not John Mark, he says, and the reason is that this writer does not know the geography of Palestine and attacks Jewish customs. And John Mark couldn't have done that. Robinson, New Testament professor at the Southern California School of Theology at Claremont. He was influenced by German radicalism. And beware that he uses words in two meanings. When he speaks about historical, it does not mean in the way that we mean by it. That's the same danger with Karl Barth. Okay. Very quickly now, a few words on F.F. Bruce. His New Testament history is, in my opinion, one of his best works. Bruce would consider himself a historian, not a theologian. De Graaf, I like his work, although you have to cue into the Christian Reformed Dutch mentality. You know, I don't have that mindset, and it's hard for me to work on that basis. But it's helpful, because sometimes I will read a passage and I wonder really what is the theology of this passage. R.M. Grant is good for a historical picture of hermeneutics, and is quite fair in his discussion of the various schools. Kelber's story of Jesus is, to me, a curiosity, and I like to use him more to tear him down than anything. But I see this as the logical result of redaction criticism. I.H. Marshall, he writes as a conservative, but that could mean anything over a wide spectrum. Norman Perrin writes as a radical liberal, and Sherman White's book I would recommend you to buy if you find in any second-hand bookstore. It's available as a reprint, by the way. Why do I recommend him? Sherman White is good for his treatment of the trial of Christ. He writes as a Latin scholar who's thoroughly familiar with Roman history and customs, legal matters.